the past, and the very, and perfect truth. The soul is that which, even a 100,000 years it not lost. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself.
Amidst the Buddha, amidst the Dharma, amidst the Sangha. The talks I've been doing during the monastic retreat have gone in the direction of a general discussion of discipleship, embracing both monastic and lay discipleship, with an emphasis in the beginning quite strongly on monastic discipleship. More recently, I've been talking about lay discipleship in particular. I want to continue that today. I had some qualms about the title I've given to recent talks, which is Love Between Master and Disciple. And although it's truly what it's about, especially if one understands love in its deepest sense, nonetheless, I think I need to say very explicitly that, and it should be obvious to everyone, I'm sure it is to everyone in this room, but it might not be to everyone who might listen to these talks, who might see the titles of the talks. That is, this does not refer to a romantic, sexual type of love. It does not refer to a romantic and or sexual kind of love. Both are highly inappropriate, and both quite literally ruin any possibility of a continuation of a master-disciple relationship once that's willfully gone into by the parties concerned. Now, it might be that master and or disciple might sometimes experience normal human feelings along those lines towards one another. But obviously, it's very inappropriate. I mean, I hope it's obvious. It should be obvious. But it's very inappropriate for that to get expressed in action. And of course, we don't want masters using their spiritual authority to press sexual advances on a disciple. Highly, highly inappropriate. And a disciple has every right and really an obligation to themselves and to the master to say no if that should happen. We all know that that has happened at times. And the reverse has happened. Disciples feeling attracted to their master, and it does happen that sometimes disciples, because of their amount of raw karma that they've still got, especially in the beginning years, to get kind of confused. Is this someone that they are married to, someone they're having an affair with, or is this a master? The karma can be very confusing. And delusion and desire can come up in confusing, bewildering, ways. So of course we have a rule of monastic celibacy, and there are a number of reasons why this exists. The deepest reason actually does not have to do with the master and disciple relationship per se. It has to do with the limitations that sexual activity has upon places upon deeper spirituality. And there are other levels, and it's certainly keeping this element from becoming something that is willfully expressed in the master-disciple relationship is a very, very, itself a very good reason for monastic celibacy. Again, if master and disciple get sexually involved with one another, it ruins their relationship. Another matter that I want to discuss briefly is the fact that the master has the right at all times to change the teaching that applies to a particular disciple in a particular area of their life. This change might come about just because something has changed in the total situation and the disciple has perhaps outgrown something that previously there was no point in giving them teaching about because they were simply incapable of leaving it behind. That's one possibility. But another possibility, and I think this happens just as often as the first one, is that the master realizes that in some area they've simply not understood or cottoned on to what's really going on, and their teaching has been a little out of focus. Sometimes, perhaps a lot out of focus. When that master learns that they've been giving in some way or other the wrong teaching, they are obligated to change it, even if it goes against what they previously said. So I want to make a comparison here between the master-disciple relationship and parents and children. I'll take my own parents for example. Both of my parents have died now, and I don't think they'd mind me saying this. My parents became parents in their early 20s. I was the second child. So I was born when my parents were 23. My older sister when they were 21. So everyone in this room, think about what kind of parent would you have been when you were 21 or 23? Then my brother came along at 25. My next sister a few years later. Then some adopted sisters. My parents wanted a big family. And were good parents. Nonetheless, this is so often the case, us older kids got a somewhat different treatment than the younger ones. Because my parents learned in their early years, in really the school of hard knocks. Well, masters are like that with regard to their disciples. Masters, when they take disciples, when people come and ask to be disciples and they accept them as disciples, masters are starting from scratch. They may have trained for decades as monks. They may have been masters for monks, but when they take disciples, it's a whole new ball game. It's like people, if you've been a monk for many years and now all of a sudden someone asks you to be a disciple, you accept them as a disciple, it's like someone who's 40 years old or 45 years old having a kid. They have more life experience than the younger people who have children. Nonetheless, it's still a new experience to them. And every parent knows what a difficult experience that is at times and how bewildering it can be. Masters are human too. Masters are learning as they go along. They get better and better at it over time. When I was a young monk, Reverend Master put it very bluntly. She said, "No master really knows what it is to be a master until they have ruined two people." She did not say this just once. I heard her say it many times. Think what a sad thing that is to say. Now, in the absolute sense, a master does not ruin anyone. You don't take away their Buddha nature. And masters do make mistakes, just as our parents made mistakes. Are we going to deny that our parents ever existed? and continue to be, actually behave like petulant children all our lives? Are we going to forgive our parents and love them and be grateful to them for giving us life into this precious world? Disciples need to be very careful. Everything I'm saying applies to lay trainees who are disciples. Anyone who isn't a disciple can see the extent, you know, can decide for themselves the extent to which they think it applies to them, whether they're formally a disciple or not. So disciples need to be very careful about deciding that a master is making a mistake in giving them a teaching that they really don't like. Be very, very careful about that. In my own case, I sit really hard on things before I give teaching that I know people are really going to not like. I meditate with it. I ask for help. Many times I've found that I have acted too impulsively. Sometimes I've had to apologize. And yet so often I've found that even if I didn't do it in quite the right way, and so often these are very difficult circumstances. But nonetheless, with time I've seen that I still delivered the message to the best of my ability, and that it was a message that needed to be delivered. Many priests are afraid to take the risk of they're involved in teaching in the way I'm describing. Well, now that I think of it, I'm one of them. I'm afraid to do this. Every time I have to do it, I have to muster my courage. Every single time. Every time I have to go through this kind of dark resistance. I don't want to do this. I want to be the kind, generous monk. I don't want to be the one who says no, or the one who drops a hammer on someone. I don't want to be the limit setter. My wants simply don't matter in doing a job that is so important to the welfare of living beings. A priest who cannot accept this simply cannot function fully as a teacher. If one has to change direction radically, in the end, if one really has to do it, so one simply has to do it and accept the consequences. As I said before, you cannot beat a truly sincere disciple off with a stick no matter what you do. If the master really is off the wall, well, the truly sincere disciple will bow to them and say, I'm sorry, you know, I cannot obey you in this, even though I would like to. And be very careful that the master is off the wall before you go and do that. You always have to give the master the benefit of the doubt, as in fact the master has been doing with you all along, or you would not be training with them, and you would not have been accepted as a disciple. Think of it from the master's point of view. The master doesn't know what he's getting when someone asks him to be a disciple. Even if he knows a person really well, he doesn't know what they're going to do. Any more than parents know what they're going to get when that little screaming package comes out of the womb. Either monastic or lay disciples who think that they can just brush off this relationship when it doesn't suit them anymore are really doing an injury to themselves. a very grave injury, just as someone who renounces their parents is doing an injury to themselves, no matter what the parents have done. You cannot just cut love off. You try to do that, you cut off something in yourself that will need to be mended one day. Therefore, just as a true marriage is, till death do we part, a true master-disciple relationship is, till death do we part. And only in the most egregious situations will a master actually disown a disciple and return him to lay life, something which I have never done, by the way. And only in the most extreme circumstances should a disciple ever even consider renouncing their master. I almost never actually make notes, but I actually made a note to myself for a few more points I want to cover here. With regard to sons, then, in general, the spiritual counseling between a priest and a lay trainee should be private between them. And I have said before, and I will just repeat here, that if I come to know that people are talking about the advice I have given them with another priest without first notifying me, or with a lay person of all things, even a family member, without notifying me that they're doing so or they wish to do so, I will simply stop giving them any advice. I will not even entertain their questions. This is far more the case in the master-disciple relationship. You should not be going on the internet to double-check what the teaching your master has given you. You should not be talking to husband or wife or friend. You should not be going to other monks about it unless you have checked with the master first. Why is this? Remember that story I told the other day about how I got one of our dogs? The Reverend Master asked me if I could help, and I first said I couldn't, and then found that indeed I really could and I needed to, because my master had asked me for help. That could not have happened if I had relied on another person's opinion instead of just going to the eternal with it in meditation. When a master gives you advice, the master is trusting you to take it to your meditation and sit with it, even if it's a great struggle. And penetrate the truth of it. And if you simply, after making sincere effort over whatever period of time is good to make that effort, you simply cannot penetrate that teaching, then you take it back to the master. And if you feel you need someone else's help with it, take it to the master and say, I'm just not making any progress here. Could I talk to so-and-so? Maybe they can help me with it. I understand your teaching. If someone does that with me, I generally say, oh, of course. And there's many Zen stories along these lines too. There is a wider Sangha refuge. I have had a number of cases where I have given someone who asked for my advice a very explicit advice that was hard for them to accept and even begin to understand. They have taken it to another person, sometimes another monk, sometimes a lay trainee, and discussed it with them and got another point of view. And shortly thereafter, their life has taken a really not good, or let's say, at the very least, more complicated direction. There's also a case with a person who respectfully hears, listens, listens to the master's teaching and then simply ignores it. My best example of this is when I led a retreat in the home of a very devout couple many years ago. And I noticed, because, you know, I'm a builder and I learned to be a builder as a monk, and I know what the building codes are, I noticed a number of problems that were fire hazards with the house. And at the end of the retreat, before I went home, I went around with the lady of the house and I pointed out these areas. Well, about 6 months later, the house burned down and the family was lucky to get out alive, and they almost lost some of their pets in the fire. And the person's demeanor was utterly respectful, and then they did nothing. And the cause of the fire was determined to be exactly the main thing I pointed out. Draw your own conclusion. If someone senior to you, especially your master, warns you about something, and you simply brush it off, you're really asking for it. You know, why be that stupid, that willfully blind? Just having a respectful demeanor is not the same as truly listening and putting the teaching into practice. The last thing I want to say about lay disciples, well, this applies to all discipleship. There's a belief floating around in Western Buddhism, or some of which thinks of it as Western Buddhism, but isn't. It is Western, but it isn't much Buddhist. That Western culture is different. That the master-disciple relationship is really something that comes out of Eastern culture. And that you can have Buddhism, vibrant, live Buddhism in the West, and you can dispense with this, or you can seriously curtail the spiritual authority of the master, which fits much, much better with this thinking goes with a democratic, liberal society where everyone has rights and where authority is questioned and constantly held accountable. I simply want to say outright, unequivocally, this is a delusion. There is no difference in reality between a true master-disciple relationship in Japan, China, India, Tibet, Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Korea, etc., than there is in anywhere else that it will manifest in the world. There is nothing intrinsically cultural in a true master-disciple relationship. There are many cultural forms of expression that do change over time. But the relationship of our Master Jiyu's disciples to her as their master is no different from the relationship of Ananda and Makakasho to Shakyamuni Buddha, of Kon Ejo to Dogen. And Rim Master herself to Koho Zenji. The true transmission is the life of Buddha flowing through a continuous pipe with welded joints going back to Shakyamuni Buddha and originating in the eternal. And we come to know the truth of that transmission, not through historical study of who begat whom, begat whom, begat whom, so to speak, spiritually in the transmission. But we come to know it by ourselves becoming disciples and realizing our oneness within the eternal with our beloved Master. So when we bow to our Master and when our Master bows back to us, Buddha bows to Buddha and Buddha disappears. And there is just the one true life of the eternal, vibrant and alive and bright and full of love and devotion and reverence, of two people who see within one another that which they love and cherish and treasure above everything in the world. The great immaculacy of the Lord of the house. Great wisdom.